Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Suzanne Eder of Solid Ground Transformational Life Coaching, and in today's interview, I'm representing Living Well magazine, for which I write a monthly column on personal growth and transformation. You can learn more about my work at mysolidground.com and more about Living Well magazine at livingwellmagazine.net. I'm really excited about today's guest because not only is he an amazingly gifted best-selling author, he's a personal friend of mine, so let me introduce him. Tom Stirner is the author of The Practicing Mind. He's also a trained jazz pianist, a private pilot, a student of archery, and an avid golfer. He teaches his techniques from mastering skills to business people, at sports clinics, and to learners of all kinds. He lives in Wilmington, Delaware, and you can learn more about him and his book at thepracticingmind.com. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So before we dive into the interview, I wanted to give people the full title of your book, which is The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. And also the tagline, Master Any Skill or Challenge by Learning to Love the Process. I'm particularly fond of the tagline because it really highlights one of the key themes of your book, which is a focus on process rather than product. And because it invites us to consider that the discipline you're talking about isn't drudgery. It's actually a foundation for loving the process of mastering the skill. Is that right?
That's very good. Very good.
So also before we start, I wanted to read just two brief excerpts from the introduction in your book so that our listeners can get a good feel for what it's all about. So here's the first one. Real peace and contentment in our lives comes from realizing that life is a process to engage in, a journey down a path that we can choose to experience as magical. The practicing mind is about remembering what you already know at some level and bringing that memory into the present, where it will both serve to place you on that path and empower you to partake in the journey. This book will reintroduce you to a process you followed to acquire a skill before you knew what process meant, and it will remind you that life itself is nothing more than one long practice session, an endless effort to refine the motions, both physical and mental, that compose our days. I just love that, especially that you dare to claim that we can choose to experience our life's journey as magical. And I also really like that notion of continuous refinement. So here's the second excerpt for the listeners. The ability to develop any skill as swiftly as possible with the least amount of effort and even to experience inner peace and joy in the process is in fact a skill in itself and one that requires constant practice to become an effortless part of who we are. So I chose these because I think they both create for us a really clear and compelling understanding of what your book is about. So let's get started. What inspired you to write The Practicing Mind?
What inspired me to write it was that I wasn't very good at any of it when I was a kid. And when I was young, I was very right-brained. My father was extremely creative. We have a lot of creative people in my family, musicians, artists. My mother was very quiet and disciplined and had a lot of mental stamina. And so I was fortunate enough that I had a little bit of a blend of both of them. But I think at least in some ways I favored my father when I was younger in that I had all these ideas. I wanted to play musical instruments. I wanted to be able to draw, all these things. And I would always start out on them with all of this vigor. And then I followed a very predictable pattern. I would that initial enthusiasm would eventually wane and drop off, and I would start to make excuses to myself as to why that was happening, and eventually I would drop it, and then I would start another cycle on something else. And I think that what really saved me from a lifetime of that was that I became, or I should say, I was always aware of that. Even as a child, I was aware of it, and it disturbed me because I felt like if I couldn't pick something that was important to me and I couldn't accomplish that one thing that I had chosen, nobody was making me play the piano. I wanted to play the piano. I asked to play the piano. If I couldn't see that through, then I felt like I really didn't have any self-power. So that created this cycle that would happen. One was that I not only didn't achieve I didn't achieve the goal, but secondly, I had this poor self-image of myself, and the two of them just kept feeding on each other. So it was about probably, about when I graduated high school, I really got to a point where I said, I have to do something about this. But I had no idea where to start, and I didn't know where the journey was going to take me. And as I said, I had no idea where to start because I didn't know what was causing me to be the way I was. And I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself to be able to fulfill the journey because I hadn't been able to complete anything else. And so when I was at the University of Delaware, someone handed me a book on Eastern thought, and it was just on basically all the religions of the Eastern world. And he had had that in one of his classes. And I had never read anything about that. And I read it, and I became fascinated and addicted to it. And I started reading everything I could on Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, all the Far Eastern philosophies. And the Zen Buddhism really kind of spoke to me in terms of its very present moment and being in the now and that sort of thing. And I started to see that when I started applying that, that I began to achieve things. And I stopped feeling that feeling of, I have to get to the goal. I started enjoying just being where I was at. By the time I hit my 30s, I had really refined that quite a bit through several other processes. And at that point in my life, people were saying, you're one of the most disciplined people I've ever met. And that struck me as being funny because I still hadn't changed that image of myself in terms of I always looked at myself as being very undisciplined. But then when I started to reflect on it, I realized that, yeah, you know, I really am pretty disciplined now, and I had accomplished a lot of things. So that was when I started thinking, I need to figure out how I got from where I was to where I am. And I wanted to express that, I think, maybe just to clarify it to myself, but that's really where the book came from. I started writing it actually in my early 30s.
Wow. You know, you bring up something that I know so many of us can relate to, which is that experience of being inspired and really excited to take something on, but then kind of losing steam as we actually begin to do it, or maybe even before we begin to do it. So would you say that that central theme of your book of focusing on process rather than product, does that directly address that experience and help us shift it?
Yes, I think the two things that address that, one is the understanding that is what impacts our experience. And then the second is to be aware when we're not functioning in the present moment, when we're not functioning in a process oriented. There are two different aspects. You know, it's like if you want to lose weight, you have to know what foods to eat, but then you also have to be ahead of yourself and know when you're starting to slip off the diet. And so I think that one of the problems that we have today is that everything in our culture pushes us to be impatient and to not be where we're at. You watch kids, you know, they're texting and there's somebody right next to them and they're not even talking to them. It's just everywhere. And because of that, we're losing that ability. We're being really being trained to not be in the present moment. So we have to first accept that we function at our highest level. This has been proven out through sports psychology. I think what's so fascinating about this whole present moment thing is that it has stood the test of time in that it has been around for thousands of years, but it's also stood the test of testing because it has been researched so thoroughly in universities and sports clinics all over the world. It's become such a standard part of understanding what peak performance is being in the present moment. And you hear athletes referring to it all the time. So we have to realize that, okay, there's the answer. There's what the answer is. We need to be in the present. You know, we need to experience present moment. And we also need to know when we're not, so that we can learn to bring ourselves back. We have to be aware of it because we can't change what we're not aware of. And once we start to get that awareness, then we can start catching ourselves, you know, when we're in the past or in the future and bringing ourselves back. And then eventually it becomes more of just who we are and how we function all day.
Yeah. So this focusing on process rather than product is a way of experiencing present moment awareness.
Absolutely.
Which, as you're saying, many of us now know is essential to peace of mind. So what pushes us out of that present moment awareness?
I think a lot of it is what we're taught, also is that, you know, we are taught that, certainly through marketing, that we're not happy and we're incomplete, and that completeness, that item, that thing, that experience is someplace other than where we are right now, and we need to go get it. So I find that that's the central theme of marketing. You need this to be happy. You know, you're not fulfilled. And this is what we go through our lives feeling like we're incomplete. And I just got to figure out what it is. It's more money, a different spouse. It's a different house. It's a different job. It's always something outside of ourselves. We never see ourselves as being in control of that. We feel like it's something that we have to go get. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I feel like is that we have to develop our awareness, as I said, of when we're not in the present, because when we do that, it's the key to the prison door. It gives us the privilege of choice. In other words, when we are aware that we're not in the present moment, then we can make a choice to be in the present moment. But if we're not, then we're just carried along through the day by our thoughts, and we visit whatever circumstance they're visiting and whatever reaction we're having to whatever thought we're having for that moment.
You know, Tom, in the book, you do such a great job of helping us understand how truly empowering it is to have that awareness and to be able to choose our thoughts rather than getting lost in them and then feeling all the stress generated by their worries and their judgments. Would you go so far as to say that without thoughts, we wouldn't experience stress?
Absolutely, because a thought is the vehicle for stress. The first thing that happens is we have a thought, and then we interpret the thought. This is good, this is bad, this is happy, this is sad, and we have a physical reaction to that. There's a new book out by Deepak Chopra called The Superbrain, and in that book, you know, they talk about the present moment, and they're studying how our brain functions in the present moment. And one of the things that they say in the book, which I really struck me, was if you can just say to yourself, everything is okay right now, you know, if you can have that realization that usually when you're upset about something or worrying, you're always anticipating something or you're reliving something that happened. You're reliving something that maybe you said yesterday that you feel badly about, or you're anticipating a situation tomorrow. Maybe money's tight and you're thinking of all these things that can happen. But if you can just squeeze yourself back into the present moment and say, everything is okay right now, it's a totally different paradigm. And so I think that that's one of the things that we have to learn to do. And there are ways to do that.
Indeed, or you would not have written the book. So I want to talk about a certain kind of thought that many of us torture ourselves with, which is self-judgment. And I could not agree more with your perspective that judgment requires energy and that none of that energy is actually moving us where we want to go. And in my work, helping clients learn to release self-judgment is absolutely essential. And I really like your distinction between judgment and analysis. So would you share your perspective on that?
Analysis always comes before judgment. We always look at a situation and we analyze it. Microsecond after that, we have this response to what our analysis is. You have to analyze something, observe it first before you can judge it. So once again, we always come back to this awareness, because awareness puts us ahead of the process. So if we can learn to stop that cycle right after we've analyzed it and not let it move to the judgment, then we get the ability to function at our highest level and in a situation of a much more inner peace. A good example of that is let's just take an extreme, and that's when Captain Sully landed the Airbus on the Hudson River. Now, you know, here's a guy that takes off, and as a pilot, I can really appreciate the situation. I mean, the chances of him losing two engines on takeoff on a two-engined airplane, it's so minuscule. I mean, it's really unbelievable. But here he is. He's got a full load of fuel. He's at a low altitude. He's over New York City. And the only thing I could think of that could have been worse was it could have been at night. But other than that, pretty much everything that could go wrong went wrong. So he's in this situation where he could say to himself, as that stuff starts to unfold, oh my gosh, this is unfair. This shouldn't happen to me. There's no way I'm going to get out of this. All these people are dependent on me. All of that dialogue, all of that judging has nothing to do with correctly dealing with the situation. And so pilots are taught to analyze and not judge. They're taught to look at the situation and not judge it. Just, this is the situation. These are the procedures that will accommodate this situation and give us the best chance. And it's probably out on YouTube or somewhere, but if you ever have a chance to listen to the conversation between him and the tower when this is happening, that's how he comes across. Very even-toned. How about if you do this? That won't work because there's no drama. I'm sure he felt a certain level of panic trying to elevate itself inside of himself, but yet he was really on an analysis perspective, and that's what he stayed on. Even the fact that he could land in a river, I can tell you that that's a very difficult thing to do. If you catch a wingtip, the airplane cartwheels, tears the wings off, it sinks. There's so many things that could have gone wrong all the way down to the last second. But he stayed in that point of not allowing himself to judge the situation, just staying with analyzing, staying very present, and analyzing each thing as it unfolded in the present moment.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing to even contemplate that. So it really is possible that we can learn to stop that, what you call the forward momentum of our, or the forward motion of our thoughts, which reminds me of another quote that I like from your book, and that is, our minds are so agitated, and that agitation has a tremendous amount of momentum. And that's kind of the key, isn't it, is to somehow find a way to pause that momentum.
Right.
So without giving away your entire book, can you suggest one or two things that we can begin practicing to help slow that momentum?
Well, the best thing that I can think of is some form of meditation. I think that meditation should be required teaching in the schools. I think the kids should have to learn to meditate at a very young age. And to me, in the context of this discussion, I think the best type of meditations are either a mantra-based meditation where you just repeat a phrase. I don't really care what the phrase is. Or a breath-based meditation where you're observing your breath or maybe counting your breaths. And the reason that I say that is because, in my opinion, when you compare them to what's called a guided meditation, where someone is telling you and now you're feeling this and now you're seeing this, is that when you are trying to follow your breath or you're trying to recite a mantra, your will plays a different role in that because you're trying to will your mind to be still. And that's, to me, I've done all types of meditation. I just find that there's a different dynamic there in that. And I think that the reason that you want to do that is because what it does is, and usually when I work with people, I say, I want you to sit in a chair for 2 minutes, close your eyes and stop thinking. And what ends up happening is they can't do it. And it for most people, it's the first time that they realize that their mind is a thought machine and it will think whether they give it permission or not. And when you start to understand that, then you start to realize that your mind will go out and start worrying about something, and it will start creating these thoughts over here, and it will start creating these reactions. And what meditation does is it pulls you away, and you become more of an observer of that. So to get back to your question here, when you begin to be able to separate yourself from your thoughts, then you have a choice. You start to see the thought coming. You start to know what the judgment is going to be beforehand, and you say, I'm not going to follow that because I know where it's going to take me, and it's not productive. It's not where I want to go. And then you actually have that choice, and that's what meditation gives us. It gets us out ahead of our thoughts and our situations. I just can't think of any other way of doing it myself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I always tell people that meditation helps us develop the capacity to step back from our thoughts.
That's very well
put. We have to practice it.
Yeah.
We have to practice that. Yeah.
And what's interesting about meditation is you don't have to try to make that happen. You just meditate. And people say, well, I had a bad meditation. There's no such thing as a bad meditation.
Exactly.
You know that. I mean,
exactly.
When you meditate, anytime that you're meditating, it's the catching yourself. When your mind takes off, you say, I'm going to sit still here and I'm going to follow my breath. And then the next thing you know, 30 seconds later, you're at the hardware store in your head, or you're at the grocery store, you're having a conversation with somebody. And then there's that blink where you catch yourself and you realize, I'm not focusing on my breath. And it's in that little instant, to use one of your phrases, is where the juice is. That's really where the power is. And what people have to realize is every time you catch yourself, you're expanding
exactly.
your consciousness, you're expanding your stamina, and it just becomes easier and easier to do. So there's never a wasted repetition, and that's what you're looking for. So ironically, it could be argued that when someone says, I had a bad meditation, what they're referring to is they were chasing their mind all the time. But that could be argued that that was a good meditation because you were aware that your mind was running all over the place and you got lots of repetitions in. Of pulling your mind back.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. That's a great turnaround. Something else in your book, Tom, that I absolutely loved were, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but you give us several processes, several ways of developing the practicing mind. And one of those you call the four S's. And again, I don't want to give away the whole book, but those four S's are simplify, small, short, and slow. And The slow, that one really, I think, is fascinating and quite paradoxical. And one of the favorite stories that you shared in your book of mine is about that time that you were so unbelievably busy. You had way more to do than it really could reasonably be done. And you chose to slow down what
yes.
you were doing when most people would have made just the opposite choice. We would have tried to force ourselves to hurry, 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 hurry. And you made the opposite choice. And when I read what you experienced, I thought that was nothing short of miraculous. I'm wondering if you could share that story with us.
Sure.
Here. Yeah.
Sure. And actually, I was one of those people that my normal reaction to that was to try to hurry, to ramp myself up, to get more done in the day. And it was, I lived 7 days a week. I mean, I had a very successful service business. So I was doing a lot of concert work. I was doing door-to-door service work, and I had a major piano remanufacturing facility that I worked in, sometimes until 12:30, 1 o'clock, you know, in the morning. And then I would go home and get up at 5:30, 6 o'clock, and the day would start again. So on this particular day, I had probably about 100 miles of driving to do, plus a very full load of work to do. I think what catapulted me into that was I was just exhausted, and I knew I was exhausted. And I felt like I had to surrender to something else because I just couldn't keep up the pace that I had been doing for so long. So I had a concert piano to prepare in the morning, and then I had to run off and do all this other stuff. So I thought to myself, you know what? I can create a break for myself just by doing things slow for this one call. I won't do it for the rest of the day, just this one call. I want to slow down because I just want to relax. So I took everything that had anything to do with time, my cell phone, anything I had on me that would give me a reference of time, I left it in my van because I didn't want to be tempted to look at it and get some sort of a clue as to where I was time-wise. And then I decided I was going to be extremely mindful in everything I did. And you know, Suzanne, it's really difficult to do something slowly. I tell people that if you really want to pull yourself into the present, anytime you start to feel like you're really getting out of control, make yourself work slowly because we're so used to working at a hyper pace. The brain doesn't like it. And actually, the brain has to become very engaged in whatever the activity is instead of doing it superficially. So trying to do something very slow, you watch this in Tai Chi. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, by doing these things very slow, walking across the room very slow, it's difficult to do because we're so used to just walking across the room. I don't know what the people in the city thought, but I walked very mindful with each step to the concert hall and up the steps. And then when I opened my toolbox, I had actually two pianos to tune. And I normally would just grab fistfuls of tools, drop them on the piano, stuff the mutes in as quick as I could, tune as fast as I could, always with this idea of that I was succeeding in accomplishing a better time in the day. And this time I made myself take out one tool at a time and put it on the piano. Everything I did was one at a time, very slowly, physically very slowly. The time it took me to take the screwdriver out of the toolbox and set it on the piano might have taken me 5 or 6 seconds. And of course, my ego was screaming at me that I was creating such a problem for myself by doing this, and everything about it was uncomfortable and wrong, and I kept pushing that down. And that was how I went through the whole service call. When I got back out to the car, which was a very mindful walk back out there, and I hit the starter on the car, the digital clock radio came on, and I couldn't believe it. I had done this call. You have to understand that I would do these pianos sometimes 20 times a week. So I was very familiar with how long it took to get in there, do the pianos, and get back to the parking authority. I had actually gained a half an hour, and I thought something has to be wrong. Then I pulled all my clock devices out. I had actually gained all this time. And the reason was because I was so mindful, there was no wasted motion in anything I did. Everything I did had total accuracy, and all of my energy went into one thing at a time. And I couldn't believe not only had I gained the time, but my whole body language had changed. You know, my shoulders, which were normally scrunched up from stress, everything had dropped down. My breathing had changed. My whole body felt different. I felt so relaxed. So I ended up using that for the rest of the day, and I had time for the first time in months to actually sit down in a restaurant and have a civilized meal. It was really a life-changing experience for me, and I've always remembered that. And so whenever I start to feel like life is getting out of control, I make myself slow down.
I think that is amazing. That blows my mind. That blows my mind. I love, love that story. So Tom, switching gears a little bit, you chose to call this book The Practicing Mind, as opposed to, say, the peaceful mind or the clear, calm mind. And I think that your understanding of the essence and value of practice is really unique. I also like how you distinguish practicing from learning. So would you share your thoughts with us about those things?
Yes. In the book, I said, we're always learning something. All day long, we're learning. But learning is different from practicing because practicing has intention in it. When we practice something, we're intending to accomplish something. When we're learning, I think the example I use in the book is you can be in a household where there's a lot of arguing and bickering and poor behavior, and you are learning that behavior. I think it's important for people to understand that practicing is something where you make a decision on what you're going to do, and you understand that it will require repetition. But while you're repeating it, you have a mindfulness about the repetition, and you also have an intention about what you're trying to accomplish. And ironically, when we do that and we detach ourselves from the goal that we're trying to accomplish through this process of practicing, everything happens much quicker, and we don't have that sense of longing to get to this certain point.
And how do you suggest that people detach from the goal? We hadn't really talked about that up to this point, but it's a point you make beautifully in the book.
Well, attachment to the goal is normal, and it comes from us being taught to be attached to the goal, because we always have this sense that, going back to earlier in our discussion, that we're incomplete. And this goal is always going to solve everything in our minds when we get to this goal. So first of all, what I tell people is usually what happens when we pick a goal, the first thing we do is attach an unrealistic expectation of how long it should take to accomplish the goal. And we usually don't have any data that goes with that. I'd like to learn to play the piano. I think in a year I should be able to do this. We don't really know. I see this. I mean, I've actually was coaching someone who was involved in visual arts. When she contacted me, she said, "I'm not moving fast enough in my visual arts practice." And I said, "Well, how fast should you be moving?" And she said, "Well, I don't know." And I said, "Well, how long have you been doing it?" And she said, 6 months. And I said, "And where do you think you should be?" She said, "Well, I don't know, but I think I should be farther along than I am." I said, "Well, how do you know that you're not farther along than you should be?" And you know, she said, "Well, I don't really know." And I said, "Well, see, there's the problem. I mean, the problem is that you set this goal and you feel like, I want to be, quote, good at visual arts. And now you've decided, you have this ambiguous idea of what good is, and you've put this attachment to this goal. And every day you're judging where you think you should be on this place out here, which you think you're going to get to, and you're going to be happy." And I said, "Are you better than you were 6 months ago?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, if you could do everything you're doing now 6 months ago, would you have felt that you were good?" And she said, "Yeah, I would." I said, "Well, your perspective of good is changing because you're expanding in your art." So I think that what ends up happening, the reason we become attached and the reason we suffer in the process is because we always tell ourselves, "I'm here, I need to get to there, and this space between where I am and where I reach my goal is this necessary nuisance or torture I have to go through, because when I get to the goal, then everything will be okay." And, you know, the people that master one piece of music, then they want to play a harder piece of music. The person that wants to make 10,000 when they get there, they want to make 20,000. I mean, it's a never-ending thing. It's part of the human spirit to want to expand, and we really save ourselves when we embrace that as a blessing, as part of what we're supposed to experience, an infinite experience of expansion, instead of getting to a certain point where, okay, you're as good as you're going to get, and that's the end of that.
Exactly. Yeah, beautifully said. So what do you most want people to gain from this book?
You know, I've gotten so many emails from people, and what people have found is that they stop hurrying in their life. They start to look at the process of getting to anywhere, whether that's accomplishing something or developing something in their life. They start to notice every moment that they're doing it, and they start to derive an enjoyment of that. And when you do that, what ends up happening is your inspiration never goes away. And you start to actually see the improvement that you're having, instead of being stuck on this idea that, well, I'm not really improving because I can't do the goal. I'm not at the goal. I want to lose 30 pounds. I've only lost 2. Yeah, but you've lost 2. I think it's the feeling that all of life is some form of practice. Everything we do, whether it's learning to have a good relationship, learning to be process-oriented, I tell people, don't attach a goal in this, you know, to say like, when I can be present moment all day long, then I'll be happy. I said, because all you've done is the same thing. You need to learn that you will always be working at being present moment. And that's the joy in it, is the fact that you're aware that you're not present and you're working towards being present. It's a paradox, I guess, is the way that you would put it.
I would put it that way, absolutely. So any final thoughts, Tom, that you wanted to share?
I would go back to the, if you do nothing else in your life, come up with some sort of a meditation practice. That is so life-changing. I know you meditate, and I meditate. It is becoming something that is used by executives around the world. Google has rooms for their employees to go into and meditate. And I also think that in our current culture and our current paradigm, it's more important than ever. There's a book out called The Shallows, And the book talks about how we're losing our ability to be contemplative, but we're gaining our ability to skim. And like we go out to the internet and we can skim through several pages and we just pick up the little bits and pieces that we want for that particular journey that we're on that day. And what the author talks about is that, you know, he said, I used to be a voracious reader. He said, and I could sit for hours and read a novel. He said, now, he said, I sit down for 10 minutes and I go, you know, I think I better go check my email. He said, I can't sit still. I can't be still. And he said, the research is showing that the part of our brain that is used when we scan things is becoming more developed and bigger. But the part of our brain that is able to focus and be in the moment and be contemplative is shrinking. So it's very important that we counteract that with something where we work on that, because, you know, we're finding that kids don't have the imagination that they used to because everything is done for them. The video game creates all the pictures in their minds. They don't read books very often. So we're losing our imagination and we're losing our ability to sit still and to be still. And I think that meditation is very valuable for all of us because it teaches us to step back, to be more of an observer and not be so reactive to the world that's going on around us.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
For your time, for your wisdom. Again, the title of Tom's book is The Practicing Mind, and I think you'll be blown away by the clarity and the elegance of his writing. I really did appreciate that about your writing, Tom. It's so clear.
Thank you.
So clear. So you can learn more about Tom and his book at thepracticingmind.com.